This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lin Mark, Wang Xiaoning, and a surprise, Roshan Kanasen, who has joined us in studios this morning. Welcome, Roshan.
I just felt like walking into the studio this morning.
You didn't walk in, you rocked in.
Oh, wow. Sorry, that is high praise coming from you.
Because it's Friday. I'm being kind.
So we can only expect this sort of behavior or praise on Fridays.
It's okay. Friday fun day. That's it. Xiaoning is really embracing the spirit of it.
I am.
So it's 7:07 in the morning, Friday, the 6th of December. And in about 15 minutes, we're going to be taking a look at the latest political news coming out of PKR, Amanah and UMNO. But before that, what's been happening in the markets?
So let's take a look at the US first. Stocks rose on trade optimism, all up about between 0.1% and 0.2%. I'm talking about the Dow Jones, S&P and NASDAQ. And before that, Asian markets yesterday closed also all in the green except for the Korean Kospi, which was down 0.4%. The rest of the region, whether it was Japan and Shanghai, were both up about 0.7%. The Hang Seng was up 0.6%. Singapore STI was up 0.5%. And divide that by half and then minus a little bit more, the KLCI closed up 0.2%.
So this morning, for more insight into global markets, we have on the line with us Carlos Casanova, Chief Asia Economist at COFAS in Hong Kong. Thank you for joining us, Carlos. Now, China has insisted that the US needs to lower tariffs if there is to be an interim agreement on trade. How do you think the Trump administration is going to proceed now, given this condition that's been set?
Good morning. So our current view is that both sides still remain a little bit far from reaching an agreement. So we are slightly less optimistic than some of the other market analysts. The main reason is that the Chinese administration requires that in order for there to be a mini deal, the U.S. administration needs to permanently remove tariffs on all of remaining exports to the U.S., which are due on December 15, by the way. So they have also very little time to come up with an agreement. It is possible that both sides decide to buy some time and shift it into next year. But unfortunately, Trump is not going to want to permanently remove those tariffs, especially ahead of the election. So our baseline scenario is still one where we have 25% on all of China's exports to the U.S., unfortunately, in 2020.
And looking at India, the Reserve Bank of India kept repo rates on hold, which was against actually market expectations. At the same time, the Reserve Bank also lowered its growth forecast. So what's your economic outlook for India now?
That is correct. So we did not expect that to be the case yesterday. We were thinking the bank was going to trim rates and then pause as a result of last week's very, very bad GDP outturn. So GDP was 4.5%. Which is very low compared to India's previous sort of growth rate of about above 7%. So the country is no longer the fastest growing economy in Asia. We think that they are concerned about inflation because inflation did tick up to slightly above the 4% target in October. And of course, you have a large agrarian society that depends on food price inflation. So they must have been very concerned about that. And as a result, the central bank, they must know something that we don't, right? That's why they decided to implement that surprise move. As a result, they are happier to tolerate lower growth. So they did lower the GDP growth rate to 5%, which, of course, puts downside pressure on everybody's GDP forecast.
Carlos, let's take a look at another big economy in the Asian region. Shinzo Abe has unveiled Japan's first stimulus package since 2016, which is about $121 billion. It's one of the largest in recent history. Does this signify a return to a looser fiscal policy? And do you think it will have any significant impact?
I think so. I think it signals a return to looser fiscal policy in general throughout Asia. The fiscal budget was planned and expected, but it was bigger than we thought it would be. And it is the case for a few reasons. First of all, they do expect growth to slow down next year as a result of everything that's going down with the trade war. But also because Japan's been doing fairly well with all of that Tokyo Olympic investment. However, the Olympics are in August, in over the summer. So a lot of that investment has already been done. So they do expect that on a pure base effect, the economy will slow even further, adding to existing pressure. So this stimulus package aims to try to smooth out or buffer some of that downside pressure as well as provide financing for all of the reconstruction work that has to take place because of the typhoon and other natural disasters. So it's a combination of factors. But overall, at around 2% of GDP, we do expect it will have a significant impact in smoothing out or at least buffering some of that downside pressure for Japan, which is one of the economies, again, that we said might enter negative growth in 2020. So at least with, on the fiscal side, that will provide enough support to potentially even avoid a technical recession next year.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Carlos. And that was Carlos Casanova, Chief Asia Economist at COFAS in Hong Kong. And he's of the opinion that that Japan's stimulus package, so he said it was larger than they initially expected at $121 billion. I nearly said billion ringgit there, force of habit. Which is, and overall, that the view is that it's quite a good thing, that it may actually help Japan avert a technical recession.
Yeah, because they do need it. I think they can already see the slowdown, right? So all the spending has already been front-loaded to build all the facilities for the Olympic Games, which is coming this summer. So the next thing is what's going to happen after that? You know, you've got to keep the economic engines going. So one way is to have another stimulus package, and you've got a perfect excuse because there was infrastructure damage as a result of the recent typhoons. So you can spend on that. But for Japan, you know, that needs to be this delicate balance because there's always this concern that they might enter into another lost decade, you know, with deflation. And, you know, GDP has always been precariously low at the 1-2%. How do you get the Japanese consumers to spend is the ultimate question in a country which has, as we know, an aging population.
And the other thing I took note of was their baseline scenario for the tariffs. They're keeping it at 25% going into 2020. So not very optimistic there. And because I think there's a bit of hope that we'll see tariffs postponed, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. We've got a few more days, a week, before we head there.
Precisely 9 days until the deadline. But also in some other international headlines this morning, Saudi Aramco has announced the final price of their IPO at 32 riyals per share. So that works out to about $8.5. And this would value Aramco, which is the world's most profitable company, at $1.7 trillion.
Yeah, it received a total of $119 billion worth in bids, and it raised about just under $26 billion. This deal being closed is synonymous with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's plans to reshape the nation, right? This is something that he's been talking about for a long time. And the sale could help get his ambitious plans to overhaul the Saudi economy and make it less reliant on oil. But, I mean, that plan is very different from how it started with the $2 trillion valuation and all of that. It's been derailed by problems at home in terms of, like, we saw the purge against the elite happen, as well as abroad by the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and the war in Yemen. So a lot of negative sentiment there.
Yeah, as a result, I mean, they had to curtail some of their ambitions and they only offered 1.5% of shares. And looking at the number of shares actually taken up, the book was actually covered 4.64 times. But when you consider the size, I mean, that's not such a big deal.
So for some quick thoughts on this, we have on the line with us Saleh Yilmaz, research analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence. Thank you for joining us, Saleh. Now, Saudi Aramco did price its shares at the high end of its indicative price range, giving it a valuation of about $1.7 trillion. So what does this say to you about the expected prospects of the company?
I think the downward revision from the $2 trillion valuations reflects First of all, the initial kind of discrepancy between the market expectations for the company and the initial expectations that were set by the Crown Prince. And I think some of the main factors behind this are concerns around the recent drone attacks on the facilities of the company, concerns around transparency of the company, as well as kind of the government's reliance on the company's financial health, essentially. So, I mean, of course, on top of this, we have an oil price that's been pressured, and certainly that doesn't help for them in terms of timing as well. But looking at the local demand right now, I mean, the local, especially retail demand, seems to be strong for the company.
So the Aramco IPO failed to secure foreign investors this time around, which is why they focused on the domestic market. Now, that said, Saudi Arabian officials have suggested there could be a future share sale. What would need to happen to bring foreign investors on board?
Mm-hmm. I think more transparency is certainly one of them. more payouts, I guess, in terms of dividends would be attractive for an investor. And it's, I mean, it's important to note that the company has been trying to do these. I mean, they have been a lot more transparent than they were before. And they have kind of committed to a progressive dividend payout policy, which certainly helps. However, I mean, currently we see both of their free cash flow yield and dividend yield below the global peers. So, I mean, we're looking at a dividend yield of below 5% for them, where the median dividend yield for the peer group globally is about 5.7%. And we look at the free cash flow yield. I mean, we have the European majors at about 10%, according to our calculations, where Saudi Aramco stands about half of that. So, I mean, surely these yields being more comparable to international peers would be something that might attract foreign interest.
Meanwhile, OPEC members are meeting in Vienna as we speak. What do you expect to come out of the meeting? Will we actually see deeper production cuts, or will they maintain the status quo?
That's a good question. I mean, before this week, and we actually ran a survey with our clients, asking them about their expectations of this meeting, and the majority expected an extension. And I think it looks very likely that the current deal will be extended to at least mid-year next year. So another 3-month extension is looking very likely. But before the beginning of this year, it was looking very likely that they would just keep the same level of output cuts. But some of the remarks we had earlier this week, especially from the Iraqi oil minister, suggest that deeper cuts may actually be on the table. And it's important to remember, I think, that the group led by Saudi Arabia likes to surprise when it comes to these OPEC meetings. So they may be kind of driving a sentiment where we're not quite expecting that, or it's still not looking very likely. But then they come out of the meeting saying they will deepen the cuts, which would obviously positively surprise the market and very likely result in a boost to oil prices, which again would certainly help the Aramco IPO for Saudi Arabia to an extent.
Well, thank you very much, Saleh. And that was Saleh Yilmaz, research analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence, who's of the opinion that more transparency would maybe make Saudi Aramco's any future share sales attractive to foreign investors, because they did try and shop this particular IPO around, didn't they? And there didn't seem to be much interest.
Yeah, they had to scale back it, and they scrapped an international roadshow. I mean, I think they didn't go to New York, they didn't go to Japan, and then they cancelled London at the last minute. And actually, they shopped around even in Asia. So they offered it to like Russia's second largest oil producer, Lukoil, who declined. And even our own Petronas was offered a block.
Yeah, and I think there was some news that even Temasek they went to talk to Temasek and other sovereign wealth funds, but no one was really biting at this valuation.
Yeah.
And in the end, that's why we've seen this pressure on the valuation drop.
Exactly. And Petronas has a relationship with Aramco, mm-hmm, because they are the joint venture partners in Pengerang. And even then, they didn't want it. I mean, there are questions about transparency, and ultimately, it's also down to valuations.
Absolutely. So it'll be interesting to see where Saudi Aramco goes from here. But up next, we will be taking a look at the latest political news coming out of PKR, Amanah and UMNO. So be sure to stay tuned for that after these messages. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.